Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of December 15th. We're happy to have with us this week Father Gerald P. Fogarty. Welcome, Father Fogarty.
Thank you.
Father Fogarty is a longtime professor at the University of Virginia, where he holds the William R. Keenan Chair and Professor of Religious Studies and History. But he's visiting Fordham University this year, where he's funded by the Jesuit community and is holding the Loyola Chair. Now, Father Fogarty has an article in this week's America called A Pope in Wartime, looking at the record of Pope Pius XII during World War II. And we thought we could begin, perhaps, Father Fogarty, maybe you could just tell us what are the common charges that are leveled against Pius XII?
Well, one of the interesting things is in 1944-1945, the World Jewish Congress, in inter office memos, said at the end of this conflict, we will have to find some way of publicly thanking Pacelli, Pius XII, and Hinsley, the former archbishop, then deceased, of Westminster, for all they have done for us. So during the war and immediately afterwards, there was great praise. The charges come from the charge of silence, and the origin is in Hochhus' play in 1963, originally produced in Germany, called The Deputy, where he argues that he was afraid, so afraid of communism, that was one of the charges, that he was afraid to speak out as he was trying to defend the rights of the church. So until 63 and 64, there was general praise for the Pope. Now, was he silent? He was absolutely silent about the Soviet Union. Never once did he speak out against it. So a lot of the charges that he was pro-Hitler because he was anti-communist, the anti-communist part is true. But I've been through the Vatican archives for the open period up to 1939. I've used the archives of several other countries, national archives, and I've never found any evidence whatsoever. As a matter of fact, after the death of Pius XI, the New York Times editorialized on an article from the Angriff, which was Goebbels' propaganda newspaper in Nazi Germany, saying that they complained about how anti-Nazi Pacelli was as a possible candidate. When Pacelli was actually chosen and at his coronation, the German government boycotted the coronation. So the evidence of his being pro-Hitler is very slim. Was he afraid of communism? Yes. But many times the evidence that people provide for it is what happens in 1945. When Truman was anti-communist, the British government was anti-communist, and the emerging German government under Adenauer was anti-communist. So it's a rather hard problem to discern.
As I mentioned earlier, these are charges that continue to be brought up. You mentioned in your article, just in the last couple of months, for example, the Synod of the Word in Rome, there was a Jewish rabbi who again raised the question about whether enough was done to prevent the Holocaust or at least speak out against the Holocaust from Rome. Now, your article is largely based on data taken from Pius XI's archives, because that was the time when Pacelli served as Secretary of State. So there seems to be a lot of information. Maybe you can kind of give us some details there.
Yeah, one of the issues is a lot of times people contrast Pius XII and Pius XI. But remember, Pacelli acted as the Secretary of State under Pius XI. You know, he was the secretary. He was the mouthpiece. Now, one of the things in my article that I mentioned was with the condemnation of National Socialism bluntly, done jointly by Pacelli and five prelates from Germany, which then was issued as Mitbrenner der Sorge by the Pope, Pius XI, as soon as that was issued, there were reprisals against the church. 2 months later, there was a protest coming from Chicago, from Cardinal Mundelein, where he referred to Hitler as, what he said was, I'm embarrassed that the German people have accepted a foreigner as their leader. An Austrian paper hanger, and a bad one at that, I'm assured. Now, this brought a protest from the German government, who said cardinals speak only in behalf of the Pope, and everybody knows that. Well, no, they don't. They speak in behalf of their diocese. Pacelli backed up everything Mundelein had done, even though it meant the Germans withdrew their ambassador. But nevertheless, the American ambassador to Germany reported back that the reprisals against the church increased. So in other words, encyclicals, speaking out, it got nowhere with Hitler.
And that may have had effect on Pius XII and how he decided his course of action during World War II.
That's what I'm saying. And the other thing is, unlike what happened with the American bishops with the sex abuse crisis, if bishops are doing their job, the Pope is not going to intrude because bishops are not the delegates of the Pope, as they were very clear in supporting Mundelein. But in the case of the German bishops, many of them were speaking out. Faulhaber in particular, of Munich, and he wasn't alone, von Galen of Münster. And as long as they were speaking out, there was no need to encourage them further. German bishops were split, to be sure, but that's another question we could come back to, perhaps.
One of the reasons that these charges keep coming up, perhaps, is because there is a certain amount of secrecy regarding at least the records pertaining to Pius XII's time as pope. Now, the Pius XI archives are open, and you draw on them in your article, but the Pius XII archives are closed. Why is one open and one closed?
Very simple. Let me give an example. The librarian for the Holy Roman Church is a cardinal. Under him come both the Vatican secret archives, which means the secreto, means the Secretary of State archives. It doesn't mean secret in our American sense. And also the Vatican Library. The Vatican Library alone is slightly smaller than the Library of Congress. But altogether, for both the archives and the Vatican Library, there are a staff of 80. For the Library of Congress alone, there are a staff of 4,000. So it's partly a lack of funding. Although I'm sure if we could get the Knights of Columbus more interested in providing staff. But the process policy has been, until recently, there was an unofficial 100-year rule that pertained through the early 1970s. So, for instance, in 1971, they would open everything from 1871, when I first started researching the Vatican archives. That's as far as I could go. And then in the mid-70s, the policy was adopted by the urging of one of the Vatican archivists that they open it pontificate by pontificate. So this is a fairly new policy, which meant they had to get the material ready faster. Before that, they could go year by year. Now they're doing it pontificate by pontificate. Now, I think it would be good for our listeners to be aware that in response to Hakluth, the Vatican did appoint a committee of editors in 1966. They began publishing a total of 12 volumes. One volume has two parts, so therefore it's officially 11 volumes. That's why you'll see two different numbers. And that was the wartime correspondence of the Secretary of State under the Pope. These 11 volumes were published between 1966 and 1981. In 1999, you can see where I live as a historian, I go back 100 years, the Holy See appointed a committee of three Catholics to look at what had been published, together with three Jews who were appointed by a Jewish group, the International Committee for Interreligious Communication. Now, Michael Maris, at the time, from the University of Toronto, one of the Jewish members, has pointed out that in regard to the question, did anybody do enough? Nobody did enough, is his argument. Now the question, so having granted that, then the next question is why? Let me finish with the archives. No one had looked at what had already been published. And the document, the language of communication of the Vatican is Italian, not Latin. And no one, hardly on the committee, knew Italian. So it was necessary to come up to speed just in learning a language. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the problems even now with the number of scholars who will come to me and say, well, do you use a translator? Well, no scholar is going to do that. You've got to learn the language yourself. So that's one of the problems. So there's two things then that people haven't looked at what was published. And I admit, anytime you have an editorial committee, you're not going to have everything. But there's also no evidence that anything was obscured. But until everything is prepared, they don't let it out. And certainly one problem is the Vatican does not respond well to protests. And they've been around for 2,000 years. It's the oldest bureaucracy in the world, and it drives you nuts. I am on record of pushing that we get more of the archives open for Pius XII. And I've been opposed by some people at the Vatican on the grounds that I wanted at least open for the war years. And some people in the archives were opposed to opening just a segment because they wanted open pontificate by pontificate. So therefore, if we could have it ready by 1945, probably we could open it sooner. But they want to go up to 1958.
We were just talking about earlier, maybe we can discuss it now, about some of the new research you're doing into this area. In particular, some of the communication that was going on between members of the Washington government and the secretary, the Pope's delegate to the United States. Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, what I had mentioned was a letter from then Colonel Donovan, who was in charge of the Office of Information. Later on, he became the director of the Office of Strategic Services, the father of the CIA. And Donovan was writing to President Roosevelt that the State Department urged him to have contact with the Vatican and sent over this Count Biondi, who was actually Leone Fumazzoni Biondi, a naturalized American citizen with strong anti-fascist credentials from his work at the Corriere della Sera in Milan. His uncle had been the former apostolic delegate to the United States, and at that time was prefect of the Congregation of Propaganda, the missionary arm of the Vatican. Therefore, he had a lot of contacts in the Pacific Theater. And the letter is dated the 16th of February, 1942, which is important because on the 5th of February, 1942, the Holy See, the Vatican, had accepted a diplomatic mission from Japan. Now, after reporting on this visit from Count Fumazuni Biondi, Donovan went on to report that, as a matter of fact, they had already appointed James Clement Dunn, who was in charge of all European information for the State Department, to receive information that Count Biondi would give him. In the meantime, the apostolic delegate, Archbishop Amleto Cicognani, paid a long visit to Donovan, that's the way he described it, in which he promised to turn over to the United States all information gathered through Vatican diplomatic channels. And then he went on to say, of course, we must keep this closely guarded secret, but it's clear the Vatican stands behind us. Now, what's interesting, I mentioned the issue of Japan, because after the Holy See accepted the diplomatic mission, Cicognani went to see Sumner Wells, then the Undersecretary of State, and drafted a protest against this to be submitted by the American representative living in the Vatican, Harold Tippmann. So the protest that went in against the establishment of diplomatic relations with Japan actually came from the Vatican representative in Washington. So obviously, not for the first time, the Vatican was somewhat divided. But Cicognani was of such a nature that he would not have done this without some authorization from above. His brother, by the way, at this point was the apostolic nuncio to Vienna, or had been apostolic nuncio to Vienna. By this time, he was in Madrid.
As you point out in the article, some of this, there's just this one record of the communication between the two sides, and anything else might not have been transmitted in writing. Although, are there any other ways to try to find more information, just to get more historical data? You said that you are looking into perhaps look into the CIA archives, for example, or is any of that available?
No. In a word. As a matter of fact, the material that I did find recently turned out not to be as useful as I thought it may be, but it's a whole file. When I say file, I'm talking about at least 100 boxes of correspondence between Donovan and the State Department to James Clement Dunn. Incidentally, the State Department has no record of James Clement Dunn, they said. They give an award in his memory annually. But nevertheless, the set of documents had been completely lost in the National Archives. Nobody had looked at it before. Well, I knew somebody had looked at it before, but nevertheless, they had no designation for it. It does pertain to the files of the OSS in relationship to the State Department. But so far, I've been through almost all of them, and I have been unable to see anything pertaining to the Vatican within those files. It's just OSS, the State Department. And since I've been blocked by the CIA in the past, but you have to know precisely what to ask for if you invoke freedom of information. And I worked for 10 years now with various people in the National Archives here. They have no information. I strongly suspect it would have been communicated orally.
Right, so there's no written record. Yeah. In your article, you talk about that it's important not to see Pius XII's legacy as black and white, and that many of his actions seem to have been misinterpreted by some of his critics. Can you give an example?
Well, one of the things is, for instance, was he just in favor of American policy? No. So some critics say he didn't follow the American policy. Others would say that the reason why he didn't speak out was because he was anti-Semitic and pro-Hitler. As I said, I have yet to find any information. I'm subject to correction. I'm still open. I'm still searching. But I've been to numerous archives now at this point, at least 10 national archives other than the United States and the Vatican. And I would say one of the things that's in the article is the fact that the leader of German resistance, who had been in a concentration camp at Dachau, Johann Müller, he came to see Harold Tippmann, the American chargé d'affaires living in the Vatican, and said throughout the war, the Pope had listened to the advice given by the German resistance, never to condemn Hitler directly, because the German propaganda machine would turn that around to make it a condemnation of the German people. And that's where you get caught. And now you had the experience of what happens, the increased persecution of the church in 1937 after Mitbrenner de Zorge. You have what happened in the 40s with the roundup of even convert Jews in Holland because of the statement of the Dutch bishops. Protest didn't seem to work. Now, a more complicated issue is the whole issue of where he stood in regard to Poland. And there you have a problem. You had German speakers within Poland, who, of course, didn't get along with the Poles, even though they may have all been Catholic. And there was a real dilemma which way to come out. And the evidence is sort of very murky there.
Now, one particular case you mentioned in your article is an allocution that was given at Christmas that even some of the supporters, a Jesuit, for example, thought was not strong enough, the language. But in your article, you point out that this was kind of standard Vatican-type language. They didn't address issues head-on, that often things were kind of vague.
Yeah, one of the issues was on December 19th, 1942, for the only time during the war, the Allies issued a statement condemning what was the atrocities committed against the Jews in Germany. Now, they asked the Vatican to sign the statement, and recently in the controversy over Pius XII, that's been brought up. He refused to sign it. He refused to sign it because the Soviet Union had signed it. And the argument of the Secretariat of State at the time was if the Pope condemns Hitler, he has to condemn Stalin. And, said the Secretary of State, after all, the Soviet Union is one of your allies. So it was a problem. In other words, the Holy See was supporting the alliance. Not that they liked the Soviet Union. That wasn't the point. Now, at Christmas, the Pope had already written what was described as a very prolix, dense treatise on restoration of Christianity as the basis of Europe after the war. And he added a few words at the end. He condemned those who were exterminated merely because of their racial or ethnic background. That has been picked up, that was picked up by the New York Times at the time as the clearest condemnation because it came from this spiritual leader who had nothing to gain. It wasn't politically motivated. It was only in the 1960s that people said, no, it wasn't clear. He didn't mention the Jews. But he included anyone who was guilty, including Stalin, therefore. Now, I used as the example you were talking about, I think, Tim, in the article, I mentioned the papal intervention in 1962 in the Cuban Missile Crisis, where John the 23rd, everybody's darling, gets up on speaking French at noon, unexpectedly on Vatican radio. I mentioned speaking French because it's a diplomatic language, therefore it was intended for a broader audience. And he said that men of goodwill should be able to come to a solution of differences not by resorting to arms, but by reliance and mediation of an international body. Everybody knew it pertained to the Cuban Missile Crisis, but he never mentioned Cuba, the United States, the Soviet Union, Kennedy, Khrushchev, or Castro. But everybody knew it. It's what I call Pope speak. In a recent book by Massimo Franco, the Corriere della Sera, comparing the development of the United States and the Vatican in the last 200 years, parallel empires, he calls it, he talks about papal opaqueness in matter of speaking because general statements are made. That's, whether we like it or not, it's what I call Vaticanese or Pope speak. So that's one of the problems with the ambiguity. Now, you mentioned the Jesuit. The Jesuit was Vincent McCormick, who was an American. He'd been rector of Woodstock College, the old Jesuit House of Studies. Then he was rector of the Gregorian University until just before the United States entered the war. When he remained in Rome with no official position, Myron Taylor, Roosevelt's personal representative to the Pope, claimed he arranged for him to stay. There's no paper trail on that one. But he kept a diary in which he was very critical of this allocution. And he contrasted it with the statement made by the American hierarchy at their annual meeting when they issued a pastoral letter in November of 1942, condemning what was happening. So he said, why can't the Pope speak out? I think he should probably get Italian or French advisors rather than German advisors. That evening, however, Harold Tittmann, the United States Chargé d'Affaires resident in the Vatican, wrote to the State Department saying, the German ambassador and his staff got the message. They boycotted the midnight mass. So the Germans got it because they were used to Pope speak in Vaticanese. You know, generic statements that you apply anywhere. Now, we don't like that because we like to be more blunt. And to speak just about what's happened recently with two candidates for the presidency suddenly turning around and embracing one another. One is Secretary of State. Here they've been fighting before they can mention names. Everybody thinks, can they possibly become friends? The Vatican survived a lot longer than the United States, 10 times longer. So they speak in generalities.
Now, you conclude your article by saying that you're not arguing that Pius the 12th was not silent, but you're rather examining the reasons for that silence. Is there an example you've come across in your research where you think that perhaps he should have spoken more forcefully or there's something he could have done?
Well, in retrospect, I wish he hadn't been so diplomatic. But remember, if you made me Pope, which is not going to happen, I would think as a historian. He was a trained diplomat, so he still trusted concordats. Concordats are agreements between the state, particular government, and the Vatican guaranteeing the rights of the church. It gave the church certain rights to speak out. So therefore, the church had the right to speak out against what happened to Catholics. And gradually, he started to speak out against others. But nevertheless, he didn't have the canonical right to speak out about what was happening to non-Catholics, much non-Protestants or Jews. Gradually, he did start doing behind the scenes, especially after the liberation of Rome in 1944, when the nuncios become more proactive, and also, by the way, when his own Secretary of State died and Bocelli acted as his own Secretary of State from then until the end of his life. Many times I've argued those who defend Pius XII, I've yet to find one in any archives. And I'm pretty much exhausted archives here, Britain, Germany, Italy, Spain, Ireland, places. I went to Ireland and Spain precisely because these were two nations that the United States and the Vatican wanted to keep neutral. And, of course, the National Archives here and the Vatican Archives. I've never met any of the people ardently defending Pius XII. They have other people perhaps doing their research, but at least I haven't met them. The other side is those who condemn Pius XII, I've not yet seen convincing evidence.
One of the reasons perhaps that this continues to be a controversial subject is because Pius XII is now, his cause is progressing for sainthood. Do you think it's wise to move forward given his controversial legacy?
Well, one cardinal whom I trust said to me several years ago, it's nobody's business but the church's. I'm not really into canonization. I'm a historian. I want to look at evidence. I wish we did have more evidence one way or another, but I don't see evidence one way or another in this regard to the controversy. I mean, I know I have many historical colleagues who will argue it's very clear. I just don't see it. But I also don't see this preventing or encouraging canonization. So therefore, I'm indifferent towards whether he's canonized or not.
Now, finally, maybe we can just end by talking about, we know you're at Fordham for the year. What other projects are you working on at the time?
Well, this project, I was led into it by a previous book I did, and Owen Chadwick, Regius Professor Emeritus at Cambridge, pushed me into doing this book because he had done something similar on Britain and the Holy See during the war, Britain and the Vatican. I argued against it at the time because I said, as a Catholic priest, nobody's going to think I'm biased. His argument was, but nobody else works in the area. So with that, when I finally, the archive started to open up about 10 years ago, I was delayed because even the United States did not have material available. Then I started working on it. So it's leading to a book where I want to show it's the United States and the Vatican. Because in the 1930s, the Vatican took a much more positive view of the United States than it had previously. And also Roosevelt played to that. Roosevelt was the first president to have direct contact with the Vatican, and it began long before the papal visit of Bocelli in 1936. Really began as Roosevelt was playing to the Catholics by 33, just after his election. In light of that, I'm looking at how there was a lot of overcoming a mutual suspicion in the 1930s, which led to a positive approach to the United States during the war, because Bocelli, as Pope, was very much aware of the United States was going to be on the side of the Allies, and once they were on the side of the Allies, the United States, the Allies would win. So it's coming to terms with the New World Order, if you will.
So this book, is there a publication date or you're working on it?
Not yet. I hope I've gotten a lot of writing done thanks to the Jesuit community at Fordham. And I have three chapters just about done. I was waiting to have more material from the National Archives that's not there. So I have enough material already from the OSS files that are available in the National Archives, plus these other National Archives like the Public Record Office in England, now renamed the National Archives.
And do you have a tentative title at this point?
No, it's not going to be called the Vatican, the United States in World War II. I know that because if you go and look at other books I've written, I was uncreative, and I have two books to start out, Vatican and. So, no, it's not going to be that.
Well, we'll have to wait for that, but we want to thank again Father Gerald Fogarty for joining us. Hope you can come maybe again before you leave back for Virginia.
I'd love to do that. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition to the America Magazine podcast. You can respond to my conversation with Father Fogarty by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. I thank Bill McGarvey, who provides the music for this show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.